Some things shouldn't be transparent, like stop signs. But what you pay for should always be clear, like Hiller's True Transparency Pricing, always clearly itemized and never any hidden fees. Because you have the right to know what you're paying for. For more information, visit happyhiller.com/truetransparencypricing. Happy you'll be if the service is free.
Call the Happy Face Truck today.
We kick off the 11 a.m. hour each and every Thursday with Godfrey, Stephen Godfrey, who joins us each week from Banner Society. You can subscribe to the podcast, Ain't Played Nobody. Godfrey, how are you, man?
I've been better. I've got whatever my two-year-old decided to give me, which is why I'm not in the studio, breathing on your microphones. Unless you wanted me to breathe on all the microphones, and then we could just leave and get 3HL sick.
Yeah, we could all, everybody at the station could just be sick. So thank you. And Paul tends to have a very low immune system where he's sick all the time. So had you even walked near the studio, he would contract whatever you have today. So thank you.
I could have killed Paul. Okay, good to know.
Hey, the Georgia loss to South Carolina. I'd like to start here.
Okay.
The Gamecocks beat the Bulldogs without really having an offense in that game. I can't figure that out, how they win by the only touchdown being a pick six. How shocked are you that the storyline is what it is, with the upset being South Carolina over Georgia?
I mean, it was the dumbest. It was like a referendum on dumb Will Muschamp football, because you had his alma mater playing like really kind of the only way a Will Muschamp offense can win a game. We've seen a methodical sort of nature of that Georgia offense all season. We've never seen them really get challenged. We've never seen them put into turnover trouble. And it all snuck up at the exact same time at home. I think they were asleep. I think they have we had a nickname for the Alabama offense in the media before Lane Kiffin got there. And some people called it the slow cooker or the crock pot. And basically what it meant was Alabama was so talented and physical on offense before they went to more of what you see, sort of what they do to it now, that they would never overwhelm you, but it was inevitable because you were going to turn the ball over. You were going to make mistakes. You would shorten your own field, and eventually they're going to come away with that 42-14 win. I think that for whatever reason, this is sort of what Georgia wanted to do. I think Kirby Smart saw a ball control offense as the best option, which, I think Georgia knows maybe that Jake Fromm isn't as good as we thought he was. I'll be totally honest with you. He's not blown me away in any situation or any particular game. I think it just caught up with them because that's not a tempo and pace you can play. Now, I will say this. 9 times out of 10, Georgia squeaks out and with the field goal nonsense and overtime. Georgia is supposed to win that game 90% of the time, but they gave themselves the variance to lose this game.
I'm watching that on the way to Denver, and I'm thinking, how is this happening? How is South Carolina on the road in Athens pulling this off in that style? And here's immediately what I thought right after I heard that they had won in overtime. Nick Saban is even better than I give him credit for, because those upsets just don't tend to happen for his teams. Georgia is substantially better than South Carolina, and an upset like that shouldn't happen based on talent. But I think it shows just how difficult it is to win every single week, no matter if you're the most talented team or not. And I think that props up Saban to me even more so.
I think truly great programs like Saban's Alabama program, they take every upset and they take every loss. And Saban loves to say this, and I don't really like repeating coaching, pablum, and because it's all cliche, but there's something to be said. He always says, you never waste a loss, right? So there's always something to learn from a loss. There's always a way to implement a loss into your system. The problem here is that when Johnny Manziel and Texas A&M beat Nick Saban's Alabama, kind of the one I'm talking about, right? The more methodical, the more methodical sort of run-based offense. This was, that was like, John Parker Wilson kind of, it was a different level of athleticism at that point. And then when you saw what A&M did their first couple of years in the league, I think it fundamentally changed what Alabama wanted to do on offense and what they could do, what they accepted. And we saw this evolution. The other two losses you think about with Alabama, just for your reference point, of course, are Ole Miss, right? But back-to-back losses to a team that was running as much talent as Alabama had on offense and putting them in situations to expose them in space. You've never really seen Alabama's defense in that particular situation since. They've understood it. I think their losses to Clemson notwithstanding, because Clemson is just as talented as Bama, that's the big secret. They always learn from a conference loss. What do you learn if you're Georgia? You're more talented. You have a deeper bench. You recruit better. You have more resources. And you could have hired anybody you wanted to as offensive coordinator, and they went with James Coley. Now, I always want to caution people when they want to blame the offensive coordinator. And I'm from the state of Georgia, and people, you know, run the damn ball, Bobo, was like a maxim in the state of Georgia during the Mark Richt era. This may or may not be on Coley. I don't know how much influence Kirby has on the pace and the tempo of the offense, but I know this. Georgia's receivers don't look like they should. Georgia's receiving core, for whatever reason, be it technique, development, or talent, are not as good as they need to be to create a vertical passing game and then thus lengthen a defense and spread them out. I think that's what happened.
Are you saying that they likely win that game with the Jim Chaney offense?
Oh, man. I think they... I'll say this, Hutton. Based on everything I know about that situation, I think they would win. I think they would easily win that game with a Jim Chaney offense if Jim Chaney was allowed to call his offense.
Okay.
If he wanted to.
It was peculiar with the style of play that they were taking in, given the circumstances of how that game was going, because South Carolina wasn't going to score offensively.
Well, Hutton, if you have a bazooka,
yeah,
and a drunk walks up to you and wants to fight with a knife, you can go, all right, cool, we're gonna get in a knife fight here, okay, or we're gonna beat each other up, or I'm just gonna turn. I have a bazooka.
Yeah, right.
And Georgia is supposed to be and has been in terms of talent acquisition and really talent development at most positions. They are a bazooka. They are the top five or six of echelon programs we talk about. This was an implementation error on Georgia's part. And honestly, this is a hard knock lesson for Kirby Smart to take in this season because, you know, we saw Florida. I think we saw the limit of Florida against LSU. This was your division. And you just really, really screwed it up.
What LSU accomplished against Florida, there's still the Bama game coming up as the high water mark for their season. Mm-hmm. But what did the win this past week tell you about LSU?
I think it's time to start talking about Ed Orgeron in a completely different way. And I don't know if, and tell me if I'm wrong, there was a hire in the top end of the SEC and the top of college football at inarguable top 20 program that was as denounced and made fun of as Ed Orgeron to LSU.
Yeah.
That happened.
Yeah.
So many of my national colleagues for varying reasons hated and just loathed the hire. And I remember I wrote a piece when he got the interim job. I went down and spent some time with him in Baton Rouge and covered that weird job search, the whole moment with Tom Herman in Texas and that courtship that sort of played out on live television because of Herman's agents. And I never understood it. I didn't get it at all. And I wrote a piece about the fact that I did, you know, I went to journalism school in Oxford at Ole Miss and my first or second job out of college was covering Ole Miss and covering Ed Orgeron in his first season. And it was a disaster. I mean, it was as haphazard and just poorly executed and thought out a coaching regime in the Southeastern Conference as you'll ever see. The difference is the guy is so effective at what he is, which is a great position coach and one of the best recruiters in football, that he was able to maintain a career between those two head coaching jobs and really learn by failing, like we talked about last segment. The man that I saw again when he got the position coach job under Les Miles, and then the guy that I spoke with when he was the interim, completely different human being, just as football smart as ever. I think the situation with Matt Canada at OC really, really hurt his reputation even further. And that kind of got played out amongst national college football writers where it was easy to take Matt Canada's side because it just seemed like Ed Orgeron was up to his old ways because he would micromanage the offense and he was head coach at Ole Miss. And kind of come to find out, Matt Canada's out of football now and Ed Orgeron is extremely happy with a very dynamic offense that Joe Brady brought in. I think this season sort of answers the question who was right and who was wrong there. I did not expect him to be this successful this fast, but I will say this. it all depends on how they look against Alabama. That is the peak. That is the summit at LSU. And if they were to lose this year, I don't think much changes at all.
Well, let's go back to the offense for a moment, because you mentioned the Canada and Orgeron spat, and that's putting it mildly. But the ability for Ed Orgeron to get out of his own way and change the offense and hire Joe Brady and allow Brady to just go to work and just get out of the way. There are too many coaches that just won't do that to me. At the college pro level, high school level, it doesn't matter.
Right.
They overanalyze everything when they have some really solid coaching options on their staff for a reason. Credit to Ed Orgeron for actually allowing his coaches to just do what they're hired to do.
Well, when he got that interim job, and again, I'm the last person in the world that would stand up for the guy, because I had to cover him at Ole Miss, and he was awful to deal with. He was tough. I've written about it before. I mean, he was as awful a coach to cover, to interact with, as you could think. And
like, in a way, let's go deeper there. Like, in a way to where he thought you were out to get him with every question?
Oh, I mean, I wrote about this when I worked at SB Nation. I mean, there was a time where I was a 24-year-old writer, first year on the beat, and wrote about a player that had suffered an injury, got the information, and it was debatable. It was the linebacker named Patrick Willis, who's since retired. He played for the 49ers. And Orgeron lost it. I mean, he went nuts. And physically it kind of confronted me in a team meeting room about it. And I mean, you know, I'm this kid reporter, terrified. You know, it's funny, we laughed about it since then, because as you both get older, you understand circumstances better. And it's not my job to hold grudges like that. And, you know, to jump ahead, I would say this. The day that I sat down with him after he got the interim job, they beat a pretty bad Missouri team. This is 2016 or 17, I think. And the first thing he did was go to Steve Ensminger, who was then the tight ends coach and the interim OC, who's still technically the OC. And he said, let's open it up, right? Because the thing that plagued Les Miles was he had all this talent in Baton Rouge, and he was notorious for getting involved with his offensive coordinators and really ruining game plans. I mean, you go back and look at the 2010 LSU team and go back and look at the 2011 LSU team and the team that loses in the Superdome and never crosses the 50-yard line against Alabama. There's so much talent on those offenses. It was an insult the way that Les Miles would micromanage that offense. And Ed Orgeron's first command as head coach was, let's open it up. Mm. You know, they passed to set up the run. They would run out of pass formation. This is none of this is novel or particularly unique, but at LSU it is, because now you're seeing, I mean, Joe Burrow is setting records every week that are team records, and it's kind of funny because we'll get these, like, you know, you get the little email notices if you're a sports writer, like, Joe Burrow set team record, and it's like 5 TDs in a game, and you're like, well, there were literally 7 Big 12 teams that do that on a weekly basis, you know. Some Big 12 quarterbacks are throwing 7, you know, touchdown passes a game. But that was the state of things at LSU. So the delegation model that you're referencing, Hutton, that has a lot to do with Dabo Swinney's influence and his success. That's someone that Orgeron kind of cited early on, where he's a CEO to Dave Aranda. You know, Ed could call a defense if he wanted to, but he and Dave, they have a great working relationship. I've been around both of them. That's Dave's offense. He's going to call, or Dave's defense. He's going to call it. He's installing those game plans. Ed is not getting in there and tinkering. And I think something about the success that Dabo had at Clemson is really influencing guys to move to that CEO style. If their schools can afford to have $2 million coordinators, that's really kind of the way of the future.
And you mentioned the collective national eye roll from media whenever the hire was made at LSU by Ed Orgeron. How much of that is just Ed Orgeron is a caricature of who we envision being in Louisiana, like with the accent and just how he seems to be the cartoon cartoon character of what the coach would be? Is it more than that, or is that just surface level, what everybody just thought they were doing?
I think a lot of that was more local, honestly. You know, I spend every Christmas in Louisiana with my in-laws, who are all LSU fans, and I think locally they kind of rolled their eyes. They call him Bebe, which is his nickname from when he was growing up in South Louisiana. I think they were a little embarrassed because of it. I think they remember making fun of this guy when he was in Oxford at a lesser program in Ole Miss. I think nationally, we just tend to make quick referendums on coaches, and we don't really entertain second acts in college football if your first one was a disaster. We don't, as much as we like underdog stories or reclamation projects, we don't really support them in the media. If a guy flames out, like, that's it, right?
Yeah.
It's funny because I think back to, like, Pete Carroll, who's a, you know, entirely unqualified coach in the league and then goes and rebuilds USC before going back to the league. When you look at the media coverage throughout all those different decades, like, he's quote-unquote the worst hire ever always. And it's funny because college football doesn't have as much of a problem with recycling head coaches as the league does. But I think there was some personal bias against him. I think some of the other candidates involved had more powerful agents who had influence over the media. I'm not supposed to say these things, but I know it's true because I see it happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the devil we deal with to bring the news as best we can. And I think that, I think a lot of high level people at LSU who wanted Jimbo Fisher for so long were just crestfallen that they got stuck with this guy who felt like a cartoon character. But, you know, in reality, is really accomplishing everything that you would want out of a Jimbo Fisher regime.
Are you you buy into the Joe Burrow hype?
I buy into the fact that he's a very talented quarterback. Obviously, recruited to go to Ohio State by Urban Meyer. They know what they're doing with their quarterbacks. I buy into the fact that the system is tailored to his strengths. He has not been put in a ton of pressure situations. I was very impressed by the way that they handled Grantham. And Florida's defense.
Yeah, they could not get to him.
That's a quality effort. Again, this goes back to really banging your head on the wall if you're an LSU fan. You can recruit really good offensive linemen. They have a nice history of developing 4- and 5-star talent from Louisiana, that coastal area, into amazing offensive linemen. It does not shock me that they were so efficient in pass protection. I don't know if he's a Heisman winner. I don't even know how to determine a Heisman winner. I think it's a very silly enterprise, but I think he's as good a quarterback in the right position, and I think the play calling is suited around him in a very unique, effective way right now. And he's just hot. You know, he's got that. When you're this successful week after week, I really do think it builds and changes your psyche.
What's the biggest surprise candidate that could be open right now across the country?
Oh man, the biggest surprise candidate that could be open across.
I mean, if you're discussing this, we've reached the midway point of the season.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming USC's on that list. Yeah, I'm sure you're discussing Vanderbilt, which we will in a moment. But who else is at the top of that list right now?
I think that this year is going to be the year where a successful college coach leaves a program somewhat unexpectedly to go to the league. And so I think I can't say, hey, it's going to be school X,
yeah,
or whatever. I mean, I still think Virginia Tech is in play. And I know that athletic director, Whit Babcock, is going to play it really, really, really close to the vest. I don't think that Virginia Tech is going to make an in-season move. There's no reason to. That streak against Virginia is a really, really big deal to them. So I think it's possible if they make a change at season's end. You know, it's hard to predict the shockers. I think the top end of the SEC is going to be pretty calm this year. I do think we could see more movement on the bottom, though.
Where does Florida go from the loss to LSU? Because it in no way knocks them off the path that they're on in the East. And considering that they're playing their backup quarterback and that they've battled through some of the injuries, I know they had some defensive linemen that were injured for this game this past week. They're still in a really good spot right now with where they sit.
Yeah, I don't think you do anything, honestly. I think this is this is the kind of SEC season that you have. They should have at least 2 losses, considering how Kentucky ended. I think they've benefited from some luck, given the circumstances of replacing the quarterback and having Felipe go down when he did. I don't think you don't really overhaul anything. It's as much of running into a buzzsaw as it can be. You kind of knew what you were doing going in there. I was impressed with their ability to answer LSU up until a point. And then I think it was a matter of having an inexperienced quarterback and just not having the same kind of offensive talent. So weird to say that about LSU, but yeah. It's the truth. That was it. That game really doesn't – that game in no way is a domination. It really is just LSU sort of outrunning them in the last couple laps of the race, so to speak. They had a penalty that killed a drive, punt situation. I mean, like, it wasn't a dominant – win by LSU, but it was still really good, if that makes sense. I know one thing, you don't do anything Georgia did. You're going into Columbia. They're going to be psyched this week, right? I mean, that win changes the entire forecast. I mean, people were asking me what Will Muschamp's buyout was 2 weeks ago. Okay, so, you know, if you're Florida, stay calm. Do your thing. And surely I think that you're going to, like, you just should never be in a situation, not to go back to the top of the segment, Hutton. I don't know how Georgia doesn't win that game.
I know.
South Carolina doesn't have an offense. I mean, that's why I would pick Florida 10 times out of 10 this week, even with a backup quarterback. So it just blows my mind.
I know we had the perfect segue earlier when we were discussing coaching and hot seats and everything, but let's discuss Vandy. Because as you watch or as you see the score for UNLV Vandy, mm-hmm. I'm curious, Godfrey, do you think poor Derek Mason, like the situation he's in with the outside factors and that he has no support within the athletic program, it doesn't seem, or do you think Mason has to be better no matter the outside factors around the program?
Well, the answer has to be both. I mean, you have to do with what you're given. And this is not his first or second year. He understands the circumstances of Vanderbilt. I think they knew they were bracing for a situation to be that bad on offense. I don't think this caught the coaching staff by surprise. And so even though there are a lot of mitigating factors they can't control that I think sort of brought them to this place, you have to step back and figure out if this is tolerable at Vanderbilt. And I'm of the opinion, I've lived in Nashville for 13 years. I say this every week when I'm on the show. I live next to Vanderbilt. I think it's an underutilized business enterprise, however you want to call it. I think Malcolm Turner was an interesting hire. I think I like the way that he's applied some of his logic. I think firing Bryce Drew is a bold move. But I think it shows that there's no tolerance for same old Vanderbilt. Now, where the real work needs to be done is inside that athletic department and undoing some of what Gordon Gee did all those years ago. And getting serious about it, because I will say this on behalf of Derek Mason. He didn't stop being a good football coach, and he is a good football coach. The last time I saw him in person, I was up at the facility. We were talking about the game plan he put together on a Thursday night back in, I think it was 2013, against Oregon and against Marcus Mariota, and how red hot that Oregon offense was. And D-Mace was the guy who authored that defense. I mean, he knows what he's doing. I think there's some frustration on both sides. It's funny because I talked a lot this season about, like, look how successful both Cal and Sonny Dykes are now that they've parted ways, right? Cal has completely changed their identity. They found an alumnus in Justin Wilcox who fits within that system and knows how to recruit California players to do something that is just a little bit more feasible. Sonny Dykes takes his air raid back to Texas, goes to SMU. They're undefeated. They might be next to Boise. The best team in the group of five, maybe Boise and Cincinnati. And so I think you could very well be in a similar situation with Derek Mason and Vanderbilt. This is not a Robbie Caldwell situation. I think Vanderbilt can do better, and I don't mean necessarily, it's not a referendum on Mason. I mean, Vanderbilt needs to take a big step back and figure out what they're doing. I was trying to Google for a second. I don't know what this year's payout from the SEC network is, but I say this about a lot of schools. You're getting that huge check too. You know, the $40 million, $50 million TV revenue, whatever it's projected to be through 2024. What are you doing with it?
Yeah.
Are you serious about this or not? And that's what you have to decide. And if you're not, then you can't get mad if he loses at home to UNLV. We now have a situation, by the way, UNLV is another school that's probably going to open this year, where we could very well have, in the first time in college football history, a team that goes 1-0 in the SEC and 0-8 in the Mountain West. It's very possible.
So what does your gut tell you about the job at Vanderbilt after the season? Is it open? Are we discussing realistic hires that we could see Malcolm Turner make? Or do you think Mason is still the coach there?
People in the coaching community are talking as if it's going to open. It's got to be frustrating for Mason. It really does, because I think that I just think there's a certain extremely unique fit to be successful at Vanderbilt. It's only happened so many times. And I think Mace suffered from the comparisons of James Franklin for a long time, but that was, again, that's the situation. You knew that going in.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that Mason does not lack for being a football coach. He's a really sharp guy. I think that what you have to do, at Vanderbilt is so ridiculously above and beyond in terms of self-promotion and just building energy. Like, it's just embarrassing how bad the home situation has gotten. It really is. You know, it's one thing when Alabama and Georgia and LSU come in, I get that, but like, that's fine. Okay, they took over your stadium. Well, during the home games where it's, you know, a UNLV or an NIU or whatever, like, no one's there. There's no energy. There's no support. I think this goes far, far beyond football coaches and offensive coordinators and losing Andy Ludwig or not having an SEC caliber quarterback or whatever. I mean, they've got SEC talent and a lot of skill positions on offense. This program needs a full and total evaluation because you can't, I don't believe, and I get frustrated when I hear this, well, it's Vanderbilt and the SEC. And I say, well, no, look at Stanford, look at Northwestern, Wake Forest, Baylor, all of these exceptional admission schools, Duke. I mean, I can go on, right?
Yeah.
There's a methodology at every one of those places that creates success.
Well,
success
and also defined. There will be a coach. There will be a coach with a business mind that will fit in with what Malcolm Turner would be thinking. I would have to assume and think, you know what? I can take advantage of the city, not necessarily the college, but the city itself and where we're located. That's a huge advantage.
Well, I think you need a politician almost, and that's what you know. Love him or hate him, that's what James Franklin is. You talk about a great CEO. I'm not saying he doesn't know ball, or he can't recruit, or he can't run a locker room. I've seen him do all that stuff. But the man could run for governor of Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
He could run for governor of Tennessee. Well, maybe not Tennessee. I don't know.
The time, he could.
Yes, and that's what you need because there are a lot of people. You know, I get a little frustrated because I hear this huffiness from the same stodgy old Vanderbilt people. But in actuality, here's the deal. If you can't spot the sucker at the table, you're the sucker. And I think you're the problem. I think this "we're Vanderbilt" nonsense has to change. Be Vanderbilt, that's cool, but be 3-9 too, because that's what's going to happen. We've seen this happen for decades at this school, and the fact that they're sitting in one of the most vibrant and interesting and attractive cities in America, and they can't recruit a football team, no.
Wisconsin, are they the most consistent TV product in top college football right now?
Why do you call it a consistent TV product?
Yeah, every time I watch them play, it's the same production level week in and week out with them.
My favorite thing is it's the best napping material going. And I think that's the biggest compliment in the world because like when you have a run based 6 yard per play offense that runs 16 play drives, like, you know, it's just unbelievable how efficient they are. It's like, you know, there's like golf naps and sometimes there's like a NASCAR nap.
Right.
Wisconsin will just lull you instantly. And the funny thing is, I don't know if I think we're talking about the wrong side of the ball. Actually, their defense is so efficient this year. That's what's allowing them to do what they're doing. Wisconsin is really fun. And they're a team that I want to, like, when we sort of talk about the playoff contenders and that small, small group of, like, upper class teams in college football, I want to put them in there so badly. I just don't know if they are equipped to deal with Ohio State in any way, shape, or form. I really hope I'm wrong, but I'm afraid that Scotty might just get blown out.
I can't wait to see that game, though, in a couple of weeks. Is that a week from Saturday? Yeah, I think it is.
I mean, when you throw in, like, Penn State, Michigan, I've actually been really impressed just by virtue of the way it's kind of shaken out. Big Ten schedule has actually produced some really interesting football this year, which is, you know, a far cry from the way it used to be where you had two dominant teams and then a bunch of, like, 13-7 games played at, you know, 11 o'clock.
9 p.m. Eastern kickoff for Tennessee and Alabama this week. What's the goal of Jeremy Pruitt and his team in this matchup?
Don't get hurt.
Yeah.
Don't get hurt. There are a lot of positives you can take away from the Mississippi State game. I know a lot of people are already framing that around what Mississippi State isn't doing or didn't do or whatever, and I get that. But Tennessee played a very, very good brand of defensive football. I think, unfortunately, for psyche and chemistry and fan reaction, everything else. Excuse me. You know, you can't pick when you play Alabama, unless you're the SEC and you put them on the third Saturday in October. But this is not going to go well. The problem is, just think about Tennessee if they didn't lose to Georgia State for a second, okay? You wouldn't have expected them to win this game. Take the positive from Mississippi State. Start looking at Missouri and Kentucky and Vanderbilt as things that you can build on. Just hit pause on the long view expectations of the Vols this weekend, if that's possible.
Hey, man, feel better. Thank you for the time. Always great. Fast hour, and we'll catch up next week.
Thank you all. See you in studio next week.
Yep, sounds great. Stephen Godfrey, Banner Society, is where you can find him, and check out the podcast Ain't Played Nobody. You can download that wherever you download your podcasts.